My name is Justin Gage, and you're tuned in to the Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions Podcast with your host, Jason Woodbury.
Welcome back to Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. This week on the show, we've got Roger Eno. Roger began his recording life in 1983 when he joined his brother Brian and Daniel Lenoir at the latter's studio in Hamilton, Ontario, to cut one of my all-time favorite albums, Apollo, Atmospheres and Soundtracks. Imbued with country and western ambiance, it suggests the vastness of space and man's ventures into it in a way that little other music does. Not only that, but it also serves as one of the foundational documents of the ambient country subgenre, which practically forms its own corner of the Aquarium Drunkard sonic universe. Eno got started with solo work shortly after that with 1985's Voices, his first solo album, and he's continued to record ever since, both in collaboration with his brother Brian, like on 2020's Mixing Colors, the first album to be co-credited to both of them, and on his own, and with a diverse cast of artists including David Gilmour, The Orb, Ja Wobble, Youth, and Channel Light Vessel, his group with Bill Nelson, Kaint St. John, and previous Transmissions guest, Laraji. His latest and second album for Deutsche Grammophon is The Skies, They Shift Like Chords. We got together earlier this year to talk about that record and a lot more, psychogeography, space travel, and I confess, before we roll this interview, I haven't seen Dune 2 yet, and I think the reason why is because I have been waiting for this podcast episode to get out into the world before I go see that. That's right, I finally had the chance to fulfill a boyhood dream and talk with Roger Eno about what he could recall about the days he spent working on the soundtrack to David Lynch's 1984 adaptation of Frank Herbert's book with, you know, Brian Eno and Daniel Lenoir as well. I'm excited for you to hear what he has to say about it. All right, that's going to do it for this preamble. Thanks for checking out Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. We're part of the Talkhouse Podcast Network. Thanks for hanging out with us, and I will speak with you a little bit more on the other side. Well, Roger, thank you so much for taking the time to join us here on Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. It's an absolute pleasure to have you.
My pleasure. It's a joy. I'm just writing music as we're speaking. Yeah. Oh. So far away. How can I help you?
Well, let's start with something kind of, we'll start with an easy one.
Right.
Your label, Deutsche Grammophon, they made a short film about the most recent record, The Skies, They Shift Like Chords. And it was a very, very illuminating view. and I really enjoyed watching it. The footage of you walking on the beach was beautiful, walking through these beautiful green paths. It was wonderful. But for a few of the sequences, you've got a dog with you. And I wondered if you could tell me more about this lovely dog. Who is this dog?
He can tell you himself. Here you go.
There he is.
There he are. This is Ted, isn't it? And he's a bearded collie, border collie cross. So he was the strain were for sheep dogs, basically, which means they're very, as you can see, very affectionate and very easy to train, which is perfect for me because I'm lazy. So this is Ted. Yeah, he's 4.5 years and he's one of my favorite beings on the planet. He's a great fella.
That's beautiful. Well, I liked getting to meet him through the through the video, and now essentially in real life. It's pretty great.
Yeah, sure. I'm in my studio, my workroom, and whenever I'm up here, he's with me, and whenever I'm outside, it's either myself or my wife, you know. And if our now adult children, he just loves people, but he's always under my table if I'm up here working, so I can ask him if I'm doing the right thing.
That's great. You know, we had James Yorkston on this podcast last year with Nina Pearson, and that was a great conversation we had. But I had asked him about his cover of your song "Just a Bloke," which
wasn't that something?
Well, it's a tremendous. I really, really enjoy the Yorkston. I forget. There's one other member of that trio.
Yeah, my memory's terrible. I'm sorry. Yeah,
but I loved that cover. And to get ready for this interview, I went and I revisited the record that your version of "Just a Bloke" comes from, which was Ted Sheldrake. So, is there a connection between the name of the dog and your former neighbor, Ted?
I think, strangely, there wasn't. My wife came up with Ted before we even got a dog. But it said, well, we've got the name, we'd better get a dog. Because we've always had dogs, but one had died before, you know, so it's time to get another one. And it was you. Oh, sorry, I'm speaking to him. I've got to stop doing that. It just drives you crazy. If dog owners go, it's so sweet. No, so it wasn't. What struck me with the Yorkson cover was how he extracted something completely different from the original, and I really liked that. He turned it from this quite melancholic, kind of bucolic event into a sort of more modernist yearning, which I thought you did a really good number on that.
Well, I love it.
Sorry to interrupt. It's a long time since I've heard it, so this is, you know, this is, I'm scratching my memory now.
Sure. I mean, it's when people look over your vast discography, there aren't a ton of lyrical works.
No.
But I've always found the lyrics on that one particularly very resonant and simple in a sort of like open-ended way, but very moving too.
Yes.
Very very moving and very sort of inviting. So I'm a fan of that song.
That's very kind of you. Part of the reason I don't usually. Although I'm thinking about my next record, maybe a different matter. I'm thinking about making it kind of more, don't take this literally, but folk-based, more of a kind of simple ensembles. But anyway, so there'll be lyrics in that. And I want my daughter to, Cecily, who sings with me. In fact, both of my daughters sing, but she does it in the main. Yes, so there'll be lyrical content in that. The reason that I don't often use it is that it's like putting a highlight in a painting. Ted, what's wrong? He's just eaten. Jamie, I'm sorry, I've just got to look at this. There's something sort of suspiciously messy going on.
Don't worry. Yeah.
All right. Oh, no, that's all right. It's just a bit of old wood. I pick up pieces of wood like this from coasts and what have you.
Yeah.
Just because of the, you know, the structure. This is a good one. Like I put a couple of washers in it, and you've got an instant funny face look.
Oh, that's great. Those are quite evocative pieces of wood. Those are things you find on the beach.
Exactly. Yeah, I spend so much time walking about, as you noticed, you know, woods and beaches and what have you. This, I don't know if you can see, just what I'm showing you here. This whole lot are fossils. And this is a fossil of a whale vertebrae.
Oh,
you
wow.
See the backbone of it. So anyway, I won't go into that. Yeah, I've just got stacks of stuff like that. And Ted has decided that he didn't want that bit, so he's eaten it.
Yeah, I'm here in Arizona, so one of the areas that we've got here that's so beautiful is the Petrified Forest, where,
wow,
you know, it's really a tremendous place. You don't take wood from that. You don't take it anymore. You know, people used to all the time.
Yeah, of course.
Now they warn you off of it, and if you want to be a good, respectful citizen, as I guess I do, you know, you don't take any, but... That's beautiful. And it's not, you know, it's funny because obviously your location, your geographical situation is so important, it seems, to your work. You really do tend to draw from your surroundings and where you're at.
Completely. I'm completely both informed and in love with this area. And there are a few poets and painters that... I admire that openly admit to being kind of local. It's often not fashionable to say that you're interested where you live, and you're actually not that much concerned about the rest of the world in terms of having to travel to get different influences and what have you. A great example of this, of course, is Seamus Heaney, the Irish poet who used to call himself or was called a poet of place. He was so influenced by his, surroundings. And I kind of take heart that if someone that great can come out of the closet and say, really, all I'm interested in for influence is where I live, which is why this is where I live. Yeah, so well spotted. I'm shameless in that. I just it's probably the single most reason, or certainly the single most. I don't know whether it's the only reason that I don't leave Britain, because there's lots of disadvantage, and I won't go rantingly political about it. But we've had an absolutely rubbish Tory government in for 13 years now, and it is terrible. And they're becoming increasingly right-wing, which you can imagine isn't right up my street. The weather is, I mean, it's a beautiful day today, but the weather is often bloody awful.
Yeah.
The people are often grumbly, which is quite comical, you know.
Yeah.
And we've got a monarchy, which is just just odd. So... I think, well, why don't I move countries? And the fact is that I adore this little pocket of essentially England or Britain, you know.
Yeah.
So hence I'm stuck in this kind of odd, dreamy world that I've invented.
I mean, I think it seems like that's a good way to go about it in terms of your musical work. I relate too, you know, being in a place like Arizona, specifically Phoenix, the capital city here.
Right,
You know, I'm close enough to L.A. to be able to go to L.A. when needed and can travel, of course. But, you know, people will ask, like, well, what are you doing there? You know, do you ever consider moving? Because you are no doubt aware, climate change is affecting this region in particular ways. I mean, last summer was the hottest summer on record in an American city. We had here in Phoenix, where we had, I think it was the most consecutive days over 100 degrees, and it gets well up to 100 and, you know, 15, 116. Yeah, it gets very warm here. So people ask me, you know, do you consider moving? Do you consider, you know, the viability of this place? And I do, of course. Those are deep concerns of mine, and I get nervous. I get nervous, but also I love
Why do you get nervous?
Well, I get nervous because I'm worried we're going to run out of water. That's a big, that's a big, and as far as I understand it, that's a necessity. So I get nervous about that stuff, and I get worried about our own right wing militias, and I get nervous what happens when a populist right wing figure starts spouting off about the scarcity of our water. You know, once they stop ignoring denying climate change, what happens when they embrace it and they start using it as a tool? So those are all some of the reasons why I get nervous. And yet, I love this place. And psychogeography, you know, there is something to it. I think of, you know, you mentioned your Irish poet. I think of Alan Moore, the great comic book and novelist, who I think he lives in Northampton, and he... So much of his work is centered there, and you would think, oh, what is there to talk about or what is there to write about? But he finds this deep resonance in where he's from, where he's at, and I can't help but find I feel some sort of simpatico feelings when it comes to that sense of being, you know, in a place or finding inspiration in a place. I guess I'm just saying I pick up on what you're putting down. It's important.
And I mean, even in this case, because I keep ducking down there because that's where my kettle is. I'm just making myself a cup of tea.
Beautiful.
Would you like one? The other thing is, I mean, our weather patterns are different here. So we get these oftenly devastatingly depressing winters, which also, I'm trying to argue to myself, have their uses. Like they can either make you fallow. So there is a period where you just stop and think about what you're doing. Or they can make, there is such clarity, like the bare trees. You can see things that you never normally would. You get literally a different view of the world when the weather is killingly awful.
Yeah.
So there's that, you know, everything, you can kind of make use of most things.
That's
true.
But
I know a lot of people will want to, like, I've never really been a great... I really like pubs, or I used to particularly love them, but you know, the clubs I wasn't really interested in. I'm not particularly interested in modern movements, although I do obviously listen to contemporary music and what have you. But I wouldn't, you know, I don't think, God, this is great, I've got to sort of investigate this. By osmosis, some goes in. But I don't feel I have to have them. I haven't got the urge to. Whereas my brother and I are very different here. Whether he, you know, he's a great explorer of new ideas. That's where he goes to. I explore old ones. So most of my time is spent, or most is exaggerating, but a great deal of my time is spent in Saxon churches of like 800 years old that are now often decommissioned. So me and Ted, and often my wife will come with us, we're the only people in there. So there's this beautiful silence, and it's the silence of centuries.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that's what I hunt for.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And to allow that into the music is a very tremendous thing. And I think that, you know, I love thinking about time in that sort of more drawn out, more expansive scale.
Yes.
And to think about to think about that, you know, I've failed, but it's come up often enough on this podcast, this notion of music as a sort of time travel or a sort of, you know, and to me, that's a really resonant way to think about it, because it can be, I mean, we know on the individual level, right, the way to hear a certain song will take you right back to some place, you know?
Certainly.
And then, strangely enough, we all also know the feeling of discovering something that's new to you musically and sort of innately understanding, I will be listening to this years from now, you know, should I be lucky enough to be around? So I think all of that plays in, and I really do. I thought that listening to the new record and revisiting the last few that you've done, the Turning Year and the record that you did with your brother Brian in 2020.
Right.
I mean, that sense of, you talked a little bit about the, in that video that I alluded to, the silences in mm-hmm. Mind the Gap. And to me, you know, silences in music also speak to that sense of expansive time, right? Of sort of like opening up a space where the listener can figure out what to do with that. And I think maybe it feels like it all pours into what you're doing, but
I beg your pardon. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, but it also sounds like it's a fairly intuitive pouring in. It's not like you're mapping this out. It's just sort of being in the place helps to bring some of that into the work. Is that how it feels?
Right. Yeah, completely right. I mean, I'm no academic, and I'm no actually theoretician. I don't really think of much what I do. Yeah. Except that I want to get, and it's often the same atmosphere that I want to get. I'm always kind of polishing to get try and get the best version of this.
Yeah.
Perhaps not, but you know, you get the idea. And that's somewhere that someone can inhabit for however long that goes on. That's where they can, that's a space for them to be and to think. Yeah. Or if not to think, to have a sleep. And I'm really happy if people do that, you know. But the, you know, I wouldn't go into, for example, as I'm sure some people have, that if you play music at this speed, you'll slow the heart rate down. So this does this to the wavelength of the brain and fiddly-da, you know, go into the more scientific ways to do this. I just think, well, if take plain song, for example. So early church music has that mm-hmm. natural inclination. It slows everything down. There's such a pace that it kind of releases you from the everyday world. Mm, so it does that naturally. And I can almost guarantee that they weren't measuring each other's wavelengths in 10
minutes,
you know. So that's kind of where I am, you know. I'm getting out there. Another master of this, of course, is Arvo Pärt.
Mm-hmm.
The Estonian composer, who I like him very much for two reasons. One, I admire his work, but I also like that he's unashamedly part of the Greek Orthodox, or actually the Eastern Orthodox Christian religion. That's what he bases. He's obviously got faith, in my opinion. I mean, I haven't read so much about it, but I think he's got faith. So what, his music doesn't sound like I'm doing this for a quick buck. You know, he's doing it because he believes that it's contributing something to not only himself, but to other people. And that's what I try and get through in maybe a more secular way.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like there is a, I suppose every listener brings their own baggage to a listening session. I hear a kind of spirituality at work in your music, and you know, that's the way it feels to me. But I think in some ways, you know, you can divide it as, you know, this line between sacred and secular, but nonetheless, what you're saying about creating a space where things can slow and can creating an alternate sort of space.
Yes.
In our world where things are so fast and unrelenting, you know, maybe there's something inherently spiritual in this notion of creating a space where you can slow down or observe at a different pace or give yourself the grace of a few moments to not be freaked out, you know, however that works. You know, I think that that's important.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It sort of goes against, my brother and I have spoken about this. He puts it in more political terms, where he says that what he's doing, or the music that, roughly speaking, he and I make, I don't know whether he was talking about me at the time, I can't remember, but such music as ours is anti-consumerism, because it doesn't make you want to do anything but basically sit down. And when you're sitting and you're not buying anything, you know, it's not saying you've got to do this, you're doing this for this reason. It's what it is in itself.
Yeah.
And that's an aspect I like very much, you know, because there's the question you have to ask yourself is, how much of anything do you need?
Yeah.
And when I write music, that's exactly what I ask myself. I think, how many notes do I actually need to make something that's going to be something of beauty?
Yeah.
And it's often surprisingly few. Like, you know, two or three will do it fine. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. I think about, you know, what Lou Reed talking about, how, you know, one chord is best, two chords is all right, three chords and you're playing jazz or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that process of reduction and removing, you know, the extraneous, that's crucial. And when I think about some of the work of yours that has meant the most to me over the years, I do think of that clarity and spaciousness as an important quality. Both you and Brian share that, you know, while there are lots of different manifestations and expressions of your musical side of things, you know, something like, I mean, I was cruising around and checking through your various works, and something like the Channel Light Vessel records, you know, those don't feel the same, you know, those have their own character and their own vibe and can often get very, you know, kind of rowdy in terms of rhythmic sensibilities and things like that.
Yes.
But nonetheless, I do think about that, that stripping away of the unnecessary to kind of get to the core seems like it's a big part of what you're after.
That is the one. What you have to do for that band, it was five different people, and it was an interesting democratic process.
Yeah.
So that we all had a kind of say in what happens. So it wasn't as though someone came up with an idea and said, right, we're going to do this. It was, we've got an idea, and if this will go this way. So it ended up to be something very unlike I would do on my own.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it was with four other people in the kind of driving seat, you know.
Sure. So for listeners who aren't sure, we're talking about Bill Nelson of Bebop Deluxe, Kate St. John, Mayumi Tachibana, I believe. Tachibana, and then of course Laraji, who's been on this podcast. Laraji is a far out dude. and I remember, you know, I don't know, eight, you know, 8 years ago, 7 years ago, the first time I ever spoke with him was recorded very, very early my time, similar to this conversation, but earlier. And it was before I was in the habit of waking up as early as I did. So I remember waking up at like 5 a.m. my time for this phone call with Laraji. Yeah. And I find, probably in part because of that conversation, that I'm really attracted to the way my brain works early in the morning before I've had time to...
Yeah. Absolutely. You know,
and this conversation with Laraji, you know, was mind-bending in such a great way. He started talking to me about some of his mystical visions and his worldview, and he's explaining these things to me, and I don't know that it made sense, but I know that I loved it. You know, I know that I loved like spending time in this imaginal zone with Laraji. Yeah. I mean, when did you first meet him? Do you remember?
It might have been as early as the late 80s.
Mm, sure.
I think so. I'm not quite sure because I know we did a tour. There was him, Michael Brooks, and myself.
Yeah.
You'd be able to check this out, Jason. Sorry, I can't remember the date exactly.
But no worries.
But it's been a long time. And the thing about Laraji, he's got such a kind of aura of loveliness about him that it's remarkably powerful. It's a great thing, you know. He's a truly unusual being, that one.
Yeah.
But just back to something you mentioned, I get up in the morning. This workroom is in my house. It's the top of my house. It's the top that runs from one end to the other. So I sleep directly below it. So as soon as I wake up, I come up here. And part of the reason for that is that, well, there are a couple, but physically it's very quiet. But the other thing is that if you start working immediately when you wake up, the editor hasn't woken up yet.
Yeah.
You get up before the critic does. So mm-hmm. you start doing things that you're not actually thinking, oh, I can't do this because it sounds like this. I can't do anything in it. You know, you edit later. You do what comes out immediately, which is still kind of partly in a, I wouldn't say exactly a dream state, but like you're talking about, wake up at five, you're somewhere else, aren't you? You
know? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that it's what I try and do is use that freedom to come up with something before, as I said, before the editor gets up and starts saying, oh, I don't know about that bit.
Yeah.
You know, say later, but get out of my life just for a few hours.
Yeah, it's really crucial to get the editor distracted or out of the room for a little while, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it's important to allow, because the editor, I find the inner editor is very good at talking me out of doing anything. You know what
precisely,
I mean?
Precisely. Precisely. Yeah, I mean, that's when he's like got his Pulitzer Prize and thinks he's really someone. Yeah. You know, yeah. I think you ought to listen to me. Oh, just give up. Stop it, you crap.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that can really stultify anything, can't it? If you just can't find a way in to start anything.
Exactly.
It can be a real headache. Yeah, so you have to sort of use subterfuge. You like, don't tell him you're going to do anything.
Right, right.
Well, I'll just go upstairs to make myself a cup of tea. Then you're
off. Yeah.
when I did that, my keyboard is right below here. I wasn't, oh, they're my legs. No, I yeah. can't do it. But
it's
anyway.
Okay. Yeah. Putting your music up online is not always the easiest thing in the world to figure out, but DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads, and as an artist, you keep 100% of your royalties and earnings. 1 million+ artists rely on DistroKid to get their music into Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, all the major streaming services. You can use it to edit your lyrics and your song credits. So important in the internet age to let people know the kind of people you're collaborating with. And DistroKid makes that easy. You can also see all your stats from the streamers and, of course, add a credit card to purchase album extras. The DistroKid app is available now on iOS and Android. Go to the app or Play Store to download it. Another record of yours that is, you know, so important to me and so many others is the Apollo Atmospheres and Soundtracks.
Oh, this God, yeah.
This incredible record that you made with Daniel Lenoir and your brother Brian. A record that, you know, there are a few ambient records that I return to over and over again. And that is that's among them. And for me, there is a quality of, you know, the sort of country-tinged quality of that one in particular. Yeah. Probably most informed by Daniel Lanois's playing
lap
on it.
Steel, yeah.
That
yeah.
lap steel. You know, that's such an incredible record, and it's I very much enjoy the film For All Mankind that you know that it soundtracked, but I also find that the record works well on its own. But I do find of course that the notion of space or outer space informs the way I hear it, even when I'm hearing it outside of the context of that film. What kind of relationship do you have with that idea of space travel or space exploration, the sort of scientific thing? I feel like in the early 80s, it probably felt maybe different than it feels now, you know, where it seems to me
it certainly did. I mean, there was an idea. Armstrong wasn't joking when he said "For all mankind."
Yeah.
Whereas now it's for Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk. So my big argument is that it's now in private hands, and this might be my old style socialism coming out, but there are some things that just work better if they're state run. There are some things that don't naturally make a profit, like healthcare. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be on the scale of yes, we cure this person or we don't, if there's a profit involved. That's just not what it's there for. And I think the exploration of space should be a similar thing. That it's not there for someone to make financial, it's there to help everybody.
Yeah.
How can you expect an Ethiopian farmer to think, well, I'd like to help the world by landing on the moon? He hasn't got a chance.
Right.
You know, do you understand that it's not a level field by any
means?
Of
course. Yeah.
And it never will be. I'm not explaining this one, but I get rather kind of upset about this, really, because one of the big differences between when the Apollo moonshots and later were being done, like the time when Dan, Brian and myself were working on Apollo, there was still the idea that it was kind of space run. NASA is, as far as I know, a government wing, isn't it? It's state funded. Whereas now it's like anyone with enough money can decide to take I'm getting worked up.
No, I love what you're saying. You know, it brings to mind a couple things. One, you know, William, I'm a big Star Trek fan.
The Shatner. What's your take on that?
Well, so Shatner went up, you know, with Bezos and he experienced, as he put it, this profound sense of loss and mourning and shame at seeing the world, the planet, and sort of understanding the damage that's been inflicted on it by you know, our current societal models or whatever, however you want to put that. But that makes me think of how so many of the astronauts and cosmonauts and people from, you know, various countries who have gone to space. I think of Edgar Mitchell, specifically the American astronaut, who experienced what he later termed as something like a sense of samadhi, you know, like all of understanding the oneness of our planet and understanding that it is a it is this blue dot in this infinite vastness of space, and sort of feeling this profound feeling of connectivity to everyone and all, and understanding that. So to me, a lot of what you're saying, the sort of privatized space exploration, it's like you're losing that. You're losing that oneness, and you're yes. making it about you, the very rich go. Individual. Not there to mention, so many of these guys are fantasizing and entertaining these notions of somehow being able to get off of this rock before things get really bad, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that to me signals a kind of that's a kind of nihilistic giving up that I just it grosses me out. And it feels at odds with the more noble elements of space travel and the idea of exploration. So I don't know. Yeah.
No, I'm with you exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And by the way, this isn't a swipe at any individual or America, which is clearly the most powerful country in terms of consumption, apart from anything else. I mean, Britain were, I'll try and not swear, but you know, we had our
you
century, our century, you wouldn't want to hear me swear. God, I can invite Tourette's. We did our bit in the 19th century of just greed, colonization, pollution. So it's kind of someone else's turn. So I'm not saying, oh yeah, everything's hunky dory here. It's just that we, you know, we had a different time to mess things up. But you kind of hope that sort of humanity will progress somehow. Like, I'm noticing at the moment, I'm seeing this correctly, that there might be a change in the idea of how much people need and how much they want.
Yeah.
How big does your house have to be? Like, if you need a car, how big does your car need to be? Instead of buying to what you can, the level of what you can, you buy to the level of what you need.
Yeah.
Which would cut down a lot of problems. There'd be more houses for people. There'd be less smoke coming out of, you know. Do you understand what I mean? And I'm just starting to see that. Or maybe I'm making it up, but I think I'm starting to see this becoming a question that's talked about now.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. I feel like, you know. I recorded a conversation for this show yesterday where I spoke with the great musician and writer Elizabeth Nelson, who has a garage rock band, a fairly political garage rock band. And we were discussing, you know, this sense, and I'm not sure how it carries across globally, but I think it probably does.
Yeah.
This sense that a lot of the old stories that we have told ourselves to make sense of the world have begun to ring hollow. They don't feel like there's anything left in them. And I do think that hopefully what you're talking about, this sense that maybe people are ready to want less or just want enough, not need that much more. I do hope that that comes and emerges, and I do hope that that begins to take hold. You and Brian played at the Acropolis was that also in 2020 or was that 2021?
21, I'd imagine, yeah.
And I wanted to ask, you know, that's such a storied location. How did that come about, and how did you enjoy that experience? And most importantly, did anybody make any Yanni jokes while you were doing it?
Any what?
Yanni, the new age artist who's famously did an album called Live at the Acropolis.
No.
Do you know him?
I mean, we would have done, but I'd never heard of him. So.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, it came about through, I think it was Deutsche Grammophon, and Brian and I share the same manager, who's this really, I mean, he's gold dust, this bloke. He's fantastic. And it was through them. So basically he set it up. I did nothing in terms of, apart from kind of pick my jaw up when he said we're at the Acropolis, because you know, you don't you don't get many things like that in your life, frankly. You know, there are iconic places to play, and that's one of them. So, and it was also, as you well know, that was the first time that Brian and I had ever played together. And the last one for me, and to a lesser extent, Brian, was that my elder daughter was singing with us.
Yeah.
And she's got a voice, just a beautiful voice. So, you know, as a dad, I just got weepy. It was not very professional, but, you know, here's my daughter. honestly, it was seeing her work, though, is something else, because she's got a kind of Laraji spirit to her. In fact, as we speak, she's studying to be a yoga teacher. She's in India at the moment. She left straight after Christmas. So, you know, she's been vegan and meditated for years and what have you. Yeah, she's another one of these people that you're happy they're in the room.
Yeah.
So that's a digression. But what I felt about it, it was a difficult one to put into words because, you know that place like you know, I'm not going to use a cliche, like your hand.
So yeah.
Just put something else in. that's steady on. So to play in such an iconic place, you know, you're walking in the footsteps of the great. You go down the stairs, and there's this bloody great picture of Maria Callas.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Pavarotti or Klempner or bloody, you know, all these classical titans, and you think, well, what am I doing here?
Yeah, I'm just a bloke. What am I doing here?
Yeah, exactly. There you go.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's incredible. And talk about that scale of time again that we're talking about.
Precisely.
Where you know, you're in this place that carries that weight of history. I mean, that's tremendous.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about another collaboration, and I think that this came really short after Apollo, but you know, I'll do a slight back story for this question. So I remember being in junior high school, which is like, you know, right before I went into high school, and I had a teacher who took notice of my interests and my sort of, you know, the things that I had going on.
Oh, lucky you.
Yeah, he noticed that I really tended to like, you know, science fiction and things like that. And so one weekend, he let me borrow two movies. He was like, you should watch these. And one was the Olivia Newton-John movie Xanadu. I don't know precisely. I did like Jeff Lynne and ELO, so that made sense degree. But the other was David Lynch's Dune, and that was That was the first David Lynch movie that I had ever seen, and it inspired for me a massive dive into the Dune books and to read Frank Herbert and all of this stuff. But right around, I think it's just a year or two after Apollo comes out, Dune comes out. And it features most of the soundtrack by Toto, but there's of course the prophecy theme, which is you, Daniel Lanois, and your brother Brian. And I wondered if you could tell me if you remember anything about, you know, how that came about and what your experience was like working on that that inclusion to the soundtrack.
Sure. Well, it came about, I think, probably because we'd done Apollo. Oh, that's a guess. But, you know, if you're in some area, a lot of people will ask you to do something in a similar area. And I know the planet Dune is different to a moonshot, but, you know, it's up there somewhere, isn't it?
Outer space, sure. It makes sense.
Get those free geezers that did that other one. They'll be all right. But the bit that I remember most, so it's working with the same people, so Brian and myself and Danny, joy to see each other again, you know, because we get on great.
Yeah.
But what struck me is when the film finally came out, the prophecy theme was mixed so low. It was, and I'm not saying this is the fact, but it looks like they felt they'd made a mistake, or they didn't like the tune, but they kind of had to put it in. So I tell you what, let's just turn it down really low, and no one will notice. I don't know. Yeah. Did you notice watching it? Did you notice that?
Well, certainly, you know, and I have the LP as well, and.
Is it turned down on that as well?
No, it's normal volume on the soundtrack. You can turn it up as loud as you want. But, well, on one hand, of course, the film Dune is famously David Lynch's only, you know, regret is that he gave up Final Cut on it and was sort of working within a big studio system and all of that stuff. I still quite like the movie and think that it has some charms, but I have always, from the first time I saw it to now, thought that the prophecy theme fits the world so much more in my head than the Toto stuff. No slight to those guys, of course, but to me, it I think of, you know, Werner Herzog and Popol Vuh, though, like the combination of those two creative entities, to me, it's really important, and it makes a certain amount of sense. I can hear more of the prophecy theme style music in the film if they had made that choice. I think it would have been a better choice. I don't know if it would have saved the movie financially. Probably not. But regardless, there are rumors that you guys had recorded a lot more music for the film.
Is that quite possible? It's so long ago now that, to tell you the truth, I can't remember. But I think. Thinking about it logically, it'd be unlikely we'd just do one piece.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So there might be at least a few shots at that, like alternatives, or because it's honestly it's so long ago that, you know, it's I can't remember, I'm afraid.
No, I respect that for sure. Was that done at Dan's studio?
Yeah, it was.
Same place you guys did Apollo, and the same place you did Voices, your solo debut.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was anyway.
That was his studio in Ontario. Is that right?
It was just outside Ontario, in a steel town called Hamilton, which was really, really strange because you had this kind of genius. You know, Dan makes landscapes, doesn't he? His productions are like these wonderful big scale paintings.
Yeah.
And the studio was high quality. It was built by his extremely weird brother, who unfortunately is dead now, who we got on very well. Well, the four brothers got on great as well. But Bob Lanois, Dan's brother, made this, he built the studio, and it was really first rate, you know. But the surroundings of Hamilton, there was this big steel mill that had now closed. It was quite down at heel as a town, but it's now like hip and happening. And part of the reason being that we worked there in the sort of early mid-80s. And it's cheap, I guess. You know, lots of artists and creatives will go to a place where it's kind of safe and cheap. And that fit those characters. I haven't been there for, God, what? It must be nearly 40 years or something, you know.
Sure. Not to mention that Dan has, opened and closed a number of studios in the time in between.
Yeah. Now, I saw him a few years ago. He was playing very near me, so I went. We had a chat together. But no, he's an LA boy now, I think, isn't he?
He is, and we recorded a conversation for this podcast many years ago at his place in LA. And when we finished, he had been we were talking about the record, one of the records he made with the other another pedal steel guy, Rocco De Luca. But then when we finished that conversation, he queued up the record that he has since released with Venetian Snares, and he turned it up and pressed play on this music, this skittering electronic, you know, very fast, you know, breakbeat type things and insane production. And he had it up at a deafening volume, loud. And it sounded incredible. I'll never forget that experience, you know?
Right.
And I just remember feeling so, having to set up my little microphones to record the podcast in his beautiful studio. It felt so incongruous, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, he's an incredible creative figure, and the work that he's done on his own, the work he's done with you, with your brother,
yes.
You know, it's all some of my favorite stuff for sure. He's incredible at creating, like you put it, landscapes and sort of environmental zones where...
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I wanted to ask you. Go ahead.
No, go on. No, please take it.
Okay. I was going to ask you about another collaborator of yours. I know in 2015 you played on David Gilmour's record "Rattle That Log,"
and I
know a recent sort of photo surfaced of you two together in a more recent session, and so I wanted to ask you when the two of you first cross paths, you and David Gilmour.
Well, again, you see, it's a very small world because he knows people that I know, and one of these people recommended me as to him for my piano playing, because although I'm not technically, what I did, just to sidetrack, instead of deciding to learn to play quickly and flashily, I decided to learn to play beautifully.
Yeah.
And that's all I can do. I mean, I can mock play jazz, which is good fun, like 30s and 40s, 20s jazz, but it's not my, you know, that's just for my personal amusement, really.
Sure.
But what I wanted to do was to make people weep. And also, it turned out, know who's playing within a couple of seconds. I wanted to get a style, and that's what I got. So David heard this friend of his and of mine were talking to each other, and I came up, and that's how this meeting came up. In fact, I've just done another session with him a couple of weeks ago, but I warned him that I don't know if this one's going to go well, because I was kind of having a breakdown. I was really mentally in a terrible place. So we did two decent days. And one flop, frankly. So whether I'll do whether any of that will be used or I'll be doing it again, that was an unfortunate period, because David and I get on well, you know, we like each other. Which the other, that's another important thing. You'll notice, like I say, he's a great bloke or this and that, or I like being in the room with them. That's sort of key to working with people for me, because there are lots of people that can play guitar or piano or drums and this and that, but if you're an arsehole, then you don't want to be with them. So you get someone that can do that, that's a nice person that you like sharing your life with.
That's the personal element has to come first in terms of your collaborative element.
So that's how the meeting was. I think it might have been actually through Nick Laird Close, who used to be in the Dream Academy, which is where Kate St. John was in. So there are all these kind of little threads that go, because basically this sort of music world is quite small. You know, you end up knowing quite a lot of people.
Yeah. Were Pink Floyd... Did they make an impression on you when they were first coming out? Was that a group that you had paid attention to or had any feeling about?
I've always liked them, but it's the same, you know, they were there like so many other people were there. There's a couple of their tracks that I think are fabulous. But I don't know if who really influenced me was Eric Satie.
Sure.
And
yeah,
that was that's who, if you know, I listen to music a lot, but there's something with some people you think, ah, they've really got something here and I want to investigate this further. And he was the one that did it. Whereas Pink Floyd, I kind of know how to make that atmosphere, but they've done it already and they've done it fantastically. So it's kind of, right, well, that corner's taken.
Yeah. No, I respect that. I respect that. And, you know, it's funny, the Satie influence is so pronounced, but it really does, to me, seem the overlap that it has with your own work is that emphasis put on beauty and expression and simplicity of expression in a non... When somebody says that the expression is simple or there's a simplicity to the music, very often that's connotes to somebody, you know, that there's something slight to it or lacking. I find it the complete opposite is the case, you know. And Satie is a perfect example of, you know, when I hear a pianist play something that reminds me of Satie, it doesn't matter how many times I've heard it; it always resonates deeply and beautifully within me, you know. I don't care that it sounds similar to a Satie, because what could be better, you know, than sounding similar to Eric Satie?
I'm very aware of that, because I can nip into almost what a cliche, so that's where I do need the editor,
you know. You got to bring him in. Sure.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I invite him in and give him a bar of chocolate so he can give good advice. Yes.
Yeah. You're somebody who, you alluded to this in terms of one of those sessions with Gilmore. You're somebody who's been very honest and open about your own struggles when it comes to mood, to depression, to your mental states. You know, how do you find... when you're in a state like that and you don't feel that the session went well, you know, that's obviously a bummer, and it's not great. Do you ever find that when you listen back to things that you recorded when you felt you were in a suboptimal state, do you ever find that you listen back and you go, oh, hey, that's actually not bad, or that maybe... It seemed like it wasn't working at the time, but it did work or whatever. Does that ever happen to you, or is it?
Yeah, that's, and also that's not reliant on whether you're, if you like, mentally fit or not. That can often happen anyway. You know, you think, oh, this is just average stuff, and then you think, actually, that's really tasty.
Yeah.
To be frank, this episode worried me. Because it was a question that I couldn't, I was just breaking into tears all the time, and I couldn't get my head around. It was an unusual chord sequence, but what would have taken me 5 minutes, at the most 10 minutes, at the most, took me an hour and a half, and I felt this is something wrong. And that's never happened to me before, because my one strong point has been that I can always, regardless of what state I'm in, I can always play music. And I've been drunk, Jason, where people have to carry me out of the party, where 30 seconds before I was playing the piano and everyone was fucking having a great time. So what troubled me about that was I thought, hang on, my castle's being undermined here. There's something else going on. And now luckily that's passed. And, you know, David and I have spoken. It's all dandy. But that troubled me, because that was something I thought, God, if this goes, what else? Because I don't mind being kind of a bit mumbly or abstract. I'm fine with that, and my wife was cool with it, all my friends, dandy, but my bastion must not crumble. You know, that was the issue there. So I haven't heard what we've done, whether it's, I think actually he did say he's been listening back and it's good, but I'm not personally be able to judge that at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I really appreciate that frankness and honesty, and I'm glad to hear that that episode passed. You know, and before we wrap up, I did want to you've mentioned, of course, your daughter Cecily singing on. She sings beautifully. That Strangely I Dreamt from the most recent record. Incredible, gorgeous, and moving rendition. So I'm excited to hear that there's going to be more collaboration with her. Your collaborations with her extend in multiple directions. She's done album art. I think The Turning Year is her That's designs. Right. She directed a music video for you. So
exactly. She takes all my publicity and Brian's actually publicity photos.
I mean, which are great. And she seems like an incredibly creative and gifted individual. I'm very curious as a parent, what were you like when it came to your children's musical sort of education? Were you somebody who like sat them down and said, you should listen to this, you should listen? No. None of that? Good. I didn't figure. But what was it like?
No, they had music in the house all the time. And that would date, because I've got, you can imagine, I've got a broad listening palette.
Sure.
So this would go from like medieval or pre-medieval to, pre-medieval, that's giving the wrong idea, early medieval, like Plain Song that I mentioned, up to sort of banging 30s jazz where everyone were just pissed up on gin, illicit gin and what have you. To the things that their friends were listening to, like, which I wouldn't, you know, like teen bands and what have you, things like that. And they, both of my daughters, played in different bands. Sis played in a wind band. My younger daughter, who's now 29, and a psychotherapist, as it happens. That's where her leaning took her. They both played instruments, so they were accruing knowledge from very many different places. But I don't know if I was too selfish to teach them myself. I'm no good as a teacher. I tried teaching this when he was about 8 or 9, this boy, accordion, and I ended up making him cry. Like in 30 minutes, I made him cry.
Oh, no.
And, yeah, he never came back, and bless him. He turned into this really big, tall, strong man that has obviously got a very kind character, because he didn't fight me when he saw me next time. So yeah, I'm not made for that kind of thing, you know. Of course, I'd give them a hand, but I think ultimately it's best that you just find out. I was very pleased. Don't get me wrong. Extremely pleased that music's a big part of both their lives, because as you probably know, Lottie's on another film. Have you seen the what's the one called Bells? Have you seen the video Bells?
No, not yet, but I'll watch it following this.
Put Bells on, and if you're in a search engine, put Bells and Voices or female voices, and the correct version will come up. And she's got an astonishing voice as well. I knew from, this is very brief because it's about my kids and I don't want to bore you, kids and dogs, who needs to hear it? Apart
These are the best things to talk about, yeah.
Right, yeah, yeah. But I knew from 8 she'd be a counsellor of some sort, you know, because everyone, all these little kids coming up to say, what shall I do, Lottie? I don't know what to do. And so sure enough, few months, she's graduating as a psychotherapist.
Yeah, well, that's got to come in handy every now and then.
God, it will for me. I tell you, I'll get mates rates.
Well, Roger, it's been such an absolute blast getting the chance to speak with you about your work. And I really have enjoyed spending time with The Skies They Shift Like Chords and revisiting your many, many records. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us and to share.
Real joy. Thank you. So, yeah, great to speak to you. Maybe we'll bump into each other one of these days.
That'd be tremendous. I'd love it. I'd love it. Thank you so much, Roger.
Okay, pal. Look after yourself, eh?
Thanks for listening to Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. We know how much competition we have for attention on the internet, so we are always so excited to have you devote time to spend with us in these conversations. I'm Jason P. Woodbury. I produce, write, and host the show. Transmissions is edited by Andrew Horton. Our music comes from Frank Mastin, and have you checked out his Aquarium Drunkard Lanyap session over on the site? He does an incredible cover of Beyond Antares from the Star Trek original series. In fact, that's what you're hearing behind me right now. You can find more tunes like it over at his Bandcamp page as well. Art for this episode was created by Ian Everett. Our executive producer is Justin Gage, Aquarium Drunkard's founder. Don't miss his weekly radio program, The Aquarium Drunkard Show, on Sirius XMU, Channel 35, at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, each and every Wednesday night. If you're looking for another way to boost this show, consider sending this episode to a friend. You can, of course, rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you listen, but I care a lot less about that than I do organic, peer-to-peer passing along. Aquarium Drunkard is part of the Talkhouse Podcast Network. Visit the Talkhouse for more interviews, fascinating reads, and podcasts. Next week on Transmissions, we've got an interview with Aquarium Drunkard founder Justin Gage, discussing some big changes headed to the site. All right, we hope you will join us then. Until we speak again, be well. This transmission is concluded.